Hello, everybody, and welcome to CommanderCast, the EDH/Commander podcast about community, strategy, and technology with weekly installments. My name is Andy, a.k.a. Ghosts. I'm the show's primary host. I'm a league organizer locally. I'm a pretty casual player. Generally, I'm the bad player on the podcast, so don't expect too much out of me in terms of actual strategy or technology or anything about that. I just pretty show up here and just keep it real with these other guys. And joining me this week on the Goon Squad, I've got Byron and Donovan, so why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
Hey guys, I'm Byron. I go by Surging Chaos online all over the place. I am a fairly competitive player, but I'm not afraid to play casually as well. I play in two different playgroups in real life. I also play online on Cockatrice, and I'm basically your typical EDH player.
Alright, I'm Donovan. I go by Dosu on the internet. I'm a really super casual player, and I like comboed.
Alright, and joining us this week as our special guest host, we have Shu from Wooburg.com. So why don't you introduce yourself, Shu?
Hi, my name's Andrew, but everybody calls me Shu, has for a long time since I made a bad joke about Chimpokemon during a game. I try to be a good source for variant formats on from Magic the Gathering, because that's just kind of something that there's not a lot of sources for. The best place Beeble Boys variants is so out of date that I think Invasion is the new set.
Yeah. So
that's kind of what inspired me to throw this stuff together, and I've been doing it on and off for, I want to say, almost 5-6 years
now. A long time, yeah. I've been reading the website for around 3 years now, we were talking about earlier, so it's been around, it's established. So if you're interested in that, there's going to be more about that in our community spotlight. But right now, we've got some podcast news. So for the midweek update this week, we're going to have the Arcane Lab is back. It's going to be serious business again this week. It's going to continue Carlos's theme of monocolor decks. This week, he's going to be doing a black deck. Hasn't revealed the general yet, but it should be interesting, as always. The Linvala deck he did was a little bit meaner than usual. So this week, I think he's going to be taking it back in the other direction. And Mistfield Plains has also posted a new Brian Stoutarm primer on his deck. It's kind of cool. I was looking at the similarities between his and mine. His is a lot better than mine. No surprise there. But that's it for podcast news. So we're going to take her right into the community segment. We're going to be doing the free-for-all roundtable on Tuck Effects. The free-for-all roundtable, and we are scheduled for 10 minutes. All right, so you guys know what that Star Trek fight to the death music means. This is the free-for-all roundtable. This is kind of a bi-weekly thing, although not precisely. We just do it whenever we really feel like it. And what we do is we discuss some kind of topic that's a little bit controversial in EDH. It could be a card, it could be the ban list, it could be a ruling, it could be a rule. And after the end of the kind of 10-minute debate, we each sum up our thoughts in a single word. So this week we're going to be talking about Tuck Effects. Now, in case you're not familiar with these, this is the kind of slang term that's developed for effects like Bant Charm or Spin into Myth, where you can take somebody's commander and put it inside of their deck, which is obviously not where it normally is. And a lot of people view this as kind of a glitch in the rules, kind of an oversight, because obviously it generally goes back to the command zone after anything happens to it. If he expires or if he gets removed from the game, he just goes there. But in this case, he ends up in the deck, and that can be really hobbling for some decks. So there's a lot of different opinions on this out there, but things more or less divide into two camps, pro or con. So this week, that's what we're going to be going over, and I guess we'll open the floor here, starting things off with Shu.
So I know I'm going to get flogged for this, because I'm probably the only one in the universe that doesn't like Tuck Effect almost universally, and I will say that there is a good time and place for a Tuck Effect. Someone's playing Ural, or Xur, or, you know, the Rogues Gallery of those kind of decks, you've got to have a Tuck Effect. But in any kind of group where there's not one of those major problem generals where basically general comes down, I win, I feel like the Tuck Effect turns EDH just into Highlander with some deck building restrictions. And I'm the variant formats guy, but the one thing you'll hear me say the most about variant formats is the reason that one is a good format is because something about it makes it feel significantly different from playing any other format. And that's why I sit down and play EDH, is because I have that consistency of the commander, because I can do the same thing over and over again. So that's my primary reason for not liking it.
Well, I actually think Tuck Effects are extremely good for the game. I think some decks that tucking the general is the only like reasonable way to actually deal with the threat. Like, for example, you know, you mentioned like Uriel and stuff, but like even the less threatening stuff like Child of Alara, like if you don't deal with that and you like you attack with creatures to win, if they could just keep replaying this Wrath effect over and over and over, I don't know how you expect to bust through something like that without, like, I don't know, ablationing their general away, so you just don't have to mess with it for a little while.
My personal response to would be to that is that's why they built in the increasing cost rule. Eventually, Child of Alara is supposed to become prohibitively expensive where they can't cast it again.
Yeah, I'd actually like to counter that point in the fact that Adam brought up the point that ramp is a very dominant strategy in Commander, and although you are, if you kill a general multiple times, yes, it does get more expensive, but if you're playing against like a mono black deck or a green deck, they're going to be running something like Cabal Coffers or Gaia's Cradle and lots of land ramp and stuff like that, and it's basically like you're just like doing it for the tempo gain, basically, and you're losing cards and resources in the process of trying to kill their general. So even though they're the general tax, you could say, is a way to deter someone from like constantly replaying their general, I will say that it's not as easy as it sounds when someone pukes out like a ton of lands onto the table and they're able to just easily recast their general turn after turn while you're just basically spinning your wheels in the ground.
I'm going to say I end up kind of on the same side as Shu on this one, actually. I think that tuck effects are important. They're good for the balance of the format, if you think such a thing is important or even exists. And I do use them a lot, but they're kind of lame. They're important if you end up in a situation like the one Donovan is describing, where there's a problematic general, or like Shu was talking about, where it's something like Xur, and it's obnoxious, and it really hurts to play against it. But in most environments that I play in, I'm not really interested in playing EDH as a skill-testing format, and I don't really care to build my deck around the prospect of losing the one thing that makes my deck unique. So in that department, like, they're a necessary evil, I would say, and it's kind of unfortunate that they have to work the way they do. I'd rather have it around than not. But, yeah, I really agree. I've never really thought of it the way that Shu said, but I agree with that. It does kind of take away from the distinctness of the format once they start to become rampant, and I think they really are becoming a lot more popular.
The other argument I have in my favor, and this has probably been brought up a million times before, too, is the colors that Tuck is in. If you flip through Tuck effects and, like, the, you know, just real briefly, you're going to find, like, 99 to 100% of them are blue and white, which I would argue are pretty much two of, if not the best colors in the and most formats. White's got answers to everything, and blue, well, it is blue.
Like, blue needs anything else.
Well, I mean, I see where you're coming from there, and I don't want to derail the topic. I would disagree that white is one of the best colors in EDH, but, I mean, that's not really the point. All right, I mean, if you want to build your deck in such a way that, you know, it just completely loses without the general, I guess that's up to you, but I don't think, you know, you can really get upset when someone takes that away. To me, that's like building a mana base is just cold as strip mine. Like, you don't want to go into every game, you know, getting expected to be Armageddoned over and over, but, you know, occasionally land destruction spell is going to get thrown around here or there, and if that's your glass jaw, you know, I don't really think there's an excuse for not trying to shore that up. Like, I don't think getting rid of an entire card archetype is, like, a good idea.
I wasn't saying that that you should build your deck in a way that the general would be the only way to win. I certainly play, you know, in my Miraxes of Keld deck is one of my favorites, and I love to smash face with giant red creatures, and the deck does have, you know, Hate Flayer and Inferno Elemental and some other really big fat too, but if the general gets tucked, it's just, you get that sinking feeling of, oh man, not everybody else has access to this super awesome card of theirs, but mine is somewhere else.
No, I've had my general tuck before quite a few times with different generals I've played, and one of the things that maybe I've seemed to realize is that once your general gets tucked, people seem to realize that they don't think that you can do anything anymore in the game, so they kind of just leave you alone. And I can see that as a potentially good thing, because if people are leaving you alone, then it lets you, gives you time to recover and build up resources. And if you do have a pretty decent deck that has a lot of, you know, good standalone effects and good synergies, then you can still pound out some action and be able to even win without the general. I mean, I'm not going to say it's totally doable, but it is possible. And I think if you do, like, get considered as, like just a non-threat when people assume your general gets tucked, I mean, I will take that if it means losing my general for an extended period of time.
Yeah, okay, so do you guys think that having your general, the ability to have it tucked and put in the deck, do you think that makes things more fun? Like, when it comes down to that, like, in terms of balance, yeah, that's a whole other argument. But do you guys think it actually makes the format better or makes games more enjoyable? Because most of my experiences with doing that, you know, is not a big deal, but I played a couple of games where, especially if it's more, you know, the players aren't necessarily on the same level as I am in terms of their deck construction, or their newer players or that kind of thing, where I'll hit their general with a spin into myth or a hinder, and they just look so deflated, like, oh, why am I even playing this? You know, now the whole reason to play EDH is gone.
I think Tuck Effects add, like, an entirely new element to the game, and for me, it is fun. Like, I mean, I'm not going to say it's fun when I get my general hindered to the bottom or anything, but it always presents an interesting puzzle, and, like, it's almost never completely crippling. Like, I think having those effects in the game, I mean, it encourages stronger deck building, so you're not just, you know, cold to one of those things. And it encourages tighter play, so maybe you have to play around something like Condemn or Hinder. Like, the format would be considerably less fun without that threat.
If my general gets tucked, I certainly just feel bummed, because I've played a lot of Highlander as well, and from my experience with Highlander, it just sort of becomes who luck of the draw pulls their best spells and who has the most redundancy, and I tend to build with very little redundancy in EDH simply because I like to, you know, play with a lot of different things. And then, you know, when my general is gone, those things, a lot of them don't even synergize with other cards that well. Or, you know, they were subpar before, but now they're okay because of the general. And it's just kind of depressing. I'm not saying that they're not healthy for the format. I'm just saying they're not fun.
Okay, I was going to expand a bit on what Donovan was saying. Basically, like, what I feel Tuck Effects do for the format is they help to keep people honest. I mean, it does encourage people to at least, like, you know, explore other avenues instead of just completely centralizing their deck around the general. Because, like, going back to the whole, like, putting your whole eggs in one basket thing, I mean, I do totally understand that you do play the format because of the general. But it's not like I don't expect that people should be able to get away all the time with being able to just completely extrapolate all the resources and devote it into just one entire focal point. I think there should be at least some give and take. I mean, I do agree Tuck Effects do suck. I mean, I'm not going to say that I don't feel bad when my general gets tucked. I mean, of course, it's not fun at all, and this is coming from a person that likes to play fairly competitive EDH. But at the same time, I feel that it is terrible when your general gets tucked. I'm not going to lie about that. But ultimately, I think it's going to boil down to the intent of someone tucking their general. Like, I think the blame kind of sides more to the person that wants to actively tuck someone's general for the hell of it, rather than tucking someone's general because it's a strategical ploy. So that's kind of where I am with Tuck Effects.
Okay, so that's all the time we have for a free-for-all roundtable on Tuck Effects. We're going to sum all our thoughts up with one word, and I'm going to go ahead and say necessary.
I'm going to go with unintuitive.
I'm going to say clutch.
Unfun.
All right, so that's it for the roundtable this week. If you guys have your own thoughts, as always, send them on in. You can get a hold of us on Twitter, email, comments, sections on various websites, whatever. You know the deal. If you don't, it's always at the end of the podcast. So that's over for now, and we're going to take it right into the next part of our community segment where we're spotlighting Wooburg.
Wooburg.com has been a site that I've been working on for several years now. I've always been a big fan of Magic's variant formats. I've been playing a long time. I'm an old guy. Started in 1994. You know, played a lot of duels. Started playing a lot of multiplayer. Started getting sick of just regular multiplayer because now I have a giant card pool. Started playing weird formats and looked them up online and found Beeble Boy's Magic variants, which is kind of the precursor to my site. I'm not exactly sure who Beeble Boy is, but his site is, like I said earlier, Invasion is the new set, according to most of his format descriptions. So I set out to make Wooburg be kind of the new source for variant format rules. I've since uploaded everything from Beeble Boys, everything that's ever been posted by Anthony Longguy, Kelly Diggs, anybody on the main Mothership website. Started working on Elric's older ones that are posted as well. Stuff from old duelists, anything I can find anywhere. I've got some user-submitted ones, some self-created ones. Basically, I'll take anything and put it up as long as it's not too close to something already there. I've got a little section that explains how to use the formats. They're separated by different categories, and there's a description on how to use that as well. I've also posted my casual ban and restricted list proposal that I made at one point when they started adding goofy stuff to the vintage list. And that actually got featured on Star City Games with in one of Abe Sargent's articles, and he liked the idea an awful lot. And we each had a little slightly different idea of the how that should be set up, but it's also on my site. I try to blog as often as I can. For a while, it was daily, then it was weekly.
Yeah, you update like a wild man. Like, I don't know how you do it.
You update almost as much as Owen.
I've been trying to do it daily, but you know, I just had a baby 3 weeks ago, so I've been a little bit...
Congratulations.
Congrats.
Thank you. My fourth and final child. They're all wonderful, healthy kids, and it's a blast, but it's also very exhausting. But yeah, I try to get something up every day. I try to do tech of as many formats as I can. The forcing people to play weird stuff around here is kind of slowed to a lull. I don't get to play weird stuff as often as I want to, so there's a lot more EDH, a lot of more multiplayer theory, just casual, anything I can come up with that sounds cool that hasn't been written about yet. I try not to post too many deck lists, because as much as people seem to like deck lists, I don't care for looking up deck lists. I don't care to share mine. But I do, I like creativity, and that's part of what WooBurg is about. It's about creativity with formats, creativity with deck building, and so that's kind of what I try to push there.
Yeah, I've been reading this site for a long time. It's just good stuff. Like, it's like the Muse Vessel, and this isn't strictly an EDH-related page. So if that's all that you want, you might be a little bit disappointed when you go to see it, but I doubt it, because there's stuff that's applicable across all formats of all banners. So even if you're not just looking for EDH material, I'd recommend you go look at it, because he has general multiplayer strategy, general magic strategy. And as well, you might have your interest picked by a couple of these variant formats he has, because there's some I'm sure you've never seen before.
And if you've got any kind of format that you see that you play that's not up there, I will add it. I've had probably 5 user submissions since the most recent iteration of WooBurg went up. By the way, the URL at these days is WooBurg, WOOBERG.weebly.com, because I've had some problems with web hosting, but I still go by WooBurg.com just because it's kind of what was iconic. I try to post the articles/posts down on the bottom right. There's a list of kind of sorting them by format, too. So if you're into just the EDH thing, you can click on the EDH/Commander one, and it'll only pull up the relevant stuff. I have something that was kind of, I don't want to say featured, but it's been around the block and back on some unused generals for EDH that seem to be pretty popular. It's got a lot of hits. I love the underdog generals. It's something I've always been plugging. I've been considering writing another underdog generals one now that the format's a little more popular. I've seen, like, Shiri Shizo's Caretaker has been getting some love after I plugged him a bit. There are a couple others that you start to see getting some love. Yeah, basically, if you've got any interesting formats or anything you want to see on the site, feel free to use the Contact Us or post on the blog there, and I'm more than willing to take suggestions. I'm always looking for new material. Once again, the site is Wooberg, WOOBERG.weebly, WEEBLY.com.
Okay, so following up on this Wooberg thing, we're going to be talking about variant formats and how they kind of coalesce with EDH. Since EDH is a variant format unto itself, it's interesting because you can template other formats on top of it and produce what feels like a fairly different game. This is something we talked about bringing up for our second season early on. I think it was at the end of the first season we said we'd be doing this, so we're finally getting around to it. We're going to be covering some one-on-one stuffs. Today, we're going to be doing Two-Headed Giant and Strategy, Plane Chase, Emperor, Star, Respawn, all kinds of cool stuff. And that's hardly all you can do. In EDH, you can find so many variants. Well, any variant you can really think of that doesn't enforce very radically different deck design principles, you can play EDH with it, and it really spices your game up. So this is just going to be kind of a primer, a general introduction to some different formats and why you might want to look into them, why you might want to play them, how they can influence your group and your games, and what their value is to any given EDH group. So I guess we'll let Shu kick things off here.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to do is kind of bounce off how you were talking about the not deck building rules modifying formats. And kind of shamelessly plug my site at the same time. The way I have them sorted, if you go to the rules variant section, anything under that heading is pretty easy to add to EDH for the most part. Those are the ones that are just, that's how you kind of have it sorted, is to where they're sorted with deck building variants. And then rules, like, which are during play variants, and that column is sort of the best way to pick things that are easy to splash into EDH. It includes the, you know, the assassin, the plane chase, all the ones with rules variants as opposed to things that actually modify the way your deck is made. And there are a couple where the deck building doesn't clash with the EDH rules or commander rules, but there are much more few and far between, because generally the deck building ones, it's pretty common to have a deck size requirement, and then you get the clash with the 100 versus 250 or 100 versus 60 and so on and so forth. But there are some of them where you can splash them together too.
Now, one of the easiest ways to kind of ease your group into playing these variant formats, I find, is Plane Chase. It was a fairly popular product when it was released, and people still seem to enjoy it. In case you're not familiar with it, it was a product that Wizards sold. It was kind of a standalone product, and it came with these giant cards that were planes, and they kind of serve as a battlefield for where you're going to be playing. Now, there are already quite a few variant rules on how to play Plane Chase, but the one we like the best is the Eternities map. I'm not going to go too far into detail in it, but there will be a link in the show notes. But what you do is you actually make a map out of the Plane Chase cards, and you can move around it, and you have some control over it. So it kind of alleviates some of the overwhelming randomness that some people did not like with Plane Chase. But Plane Chase is one of the easiest ways to add a kind of new set of rules, add a little spice to your games, and keep things varied. I think, in general, that's what you want to do or be looking for with these alternate formats. If you're one of the people that's starting to find EDH is getting a little well-worn, maybe spice it up with one of these things.
I just wanted to echo the sentiment that Plane Chase is an excellent starting point for people looking for alternate formats. And make no mistake, even with like the Eternities map, like it's still really random. You don't want to play something like Plane Chase if you know you're always looking for the optimal play and you hate it when some things are left up to chance, because let's face it, like when you start paying mana to roll dice and have all these random outcomes, like people just get blowouts all the time and other people just get screwed over. But it is extremely fun and it's worth looking into.
Yeah, I've got to reinforce that sentiment and also say, just kind of mention that Plane Chase is actually just one of Wizards' ways that they've kind of rewritten and redone an older format. For those of you who are familiar with or aren't familiar with Chaos Magic, it's actually kind of the ancestor of Plane Chase, where what they did originally, back when we were dinosaurs and banding was new, we took all the enchant worlds, which are just a subset of enchantments that kind of work legendary, kind of don't, and they stacked those up and flipped them over like Plane Chase. There was no dice. Well, there was a dice roll, I think, but I don't know. You can find it on my website, and that's kind of the ancestor, too, if you're interested in kind of mixing up the Plane Chase idea but using some different cards. And there's even versions of it where you can use just any enchantment you feel like, or sorceries, too, and there's one that's got a table you can roll on. So there's a bunch of other ways you can play similarly to Plane Chase that are really fun as well, won't you, if you want to take it to the next level.
Yeah, I was actually going to jump in and mention Chaos Magic myself, Shu, because I actually kind of find it ironic because I'm one of the youngest people on here that play Magic, and Chaos Magic is pretty old in general. But Armada Games used to do Chaos Magic in their league, and we know how Armada Games gets quite a bit of publicity, especially with their point system and all that stuff, but that's for a different day. But for the most part, my experience with variant Magic has been, again, mainly with Plane Chase, as most of you guys have pointed out. And we kind of do what Andy says, where we lay out a map, so we'll actually have like a we'll do like a little compass, so we'll have like north of the current plane being like some random plane, and then west and east and south are all random planes. So at least you still have some control over like where you could planes walk to, but it doesn't like it, you still have the randomness in there. And it is fun. I mean, like, I don't know if any of you guys have played like Pokemon or something like that, but like playing like metronome battles where all you're doing is just throwing out metronome and getting random attacks and stuff like that. It's kind of like what it's like when you're playing Plane Chase. I mean, even for a competitive player like me, it's just like, it's just a great way to blow off steam or just like something like that. So shout outs to everyone that actually plays Pokemon out there. I mean, I don't play it anymore, but I remember doing metronome battles all day, every day. And that's kind of the feeling I get from playing Plane Chase.
Okay. So, now, another thing that you might want to look at, especially if you've played a lot of free for all and maybe you're getting tired of that for one reason or another, maybe you're the guy that everyone gangs up on, maybe you're tired of having to gang up on one guy all the time, you can implement one of any number of team games, and those really provide an enormous shift, especially depending on the number of players you have. Like a three-way two-headed game has completely different flavor from a six-person free-for-all. And Emperor games, you're playing a completely different game at that point. Like, I really like two-headed. I think it's a lot of fun, and that's why we're going to be talking about it in the strategy segment, because, you know, it's kind of the one I like the best, so it's the one we talk about first. But Emperor is a little bit more complex. If you're interested in building decks specifically to play variant formats, this one provides a wealth of opportunities for totally different perspective of building your decks. So if you're looking for a new challenge, I'd really recommend looking up Emperor, as long as you have a steady group of six guys.
Right. I was actually going to say something about, Byron was talking about how it's kind of fun to just add a random element to the game, and it was kind of like having metronome battles. Another variant format that reminds me of is Vanguard. I know people play like Momir Basic, and I mean, that game's almost entirely chance. Like
Mojisto.
Yeah.
I do love me some Vanguard. I have a whole set of those things that I worked really hard to get. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it definitely has, you know, a huge random element, but there's some play skill too, but it's all kinds of fun. I'd recommend checking it out.
The best part about Vanguard is, too, you can make it have as much play skill as you want to, because you can say bring your own Vanguard, you can say just, you know, pick them at random, you could pick three at random. Abe Sargent wrote an entire article about Vanguard and some ways to randomize it. It's good stuff.
Now, obviously, the most prevalent alternative format is one-on-one EDH, and it does have its own ban list. That's how, you know, kind of overwhelmingly popular it is. If you're not familiar with it, the French ban list will be posted in the show notes. Now, one-on-one is kind of it's almost a contentious subject, I would say, because a lot of people say, well, the whole deal with EDH is that it's a multiplayer format, and it's casual, and the one-on-one decks tend to be really cutthroat and competitive. Like, what do you guys think about one-on-one, especially as a way to kind of mix up a regular multiplayer group? What do you think the validity is of it there? Or do you think it's kind of something you have to get into separately?
I mean, it's easy enough to play a pickup game of 1v1, and that could be loads of fun. But if people start playing dedicated 1v1, if that's the primary format that they decide to start playing for EDH, then that's another can of worms entirely. So it's completely different from multiplayer Magic.
I basically consider one-on-one its own separate format, simply because if you build for one-on-one, it's a completely different universe. It's much more competitive. And even if you don't build for it and you sit down to a pickup game, it's hard to even explain. All I know is there was at PAX 3 or 4 years ago, I sat down across from Ken Nagel to Gunsling and asked if he wanted to play EDH, and he pulled out Godo and I pulled out, I think it was Zerillion of the Claw at the time. And it just wasn't as much fun. We both had real cool decks. Ken is a really great guy to play against, but he wasn't having as much fun. I wasn't having as much fun, and I even won, and I got my pack, but it just felt like, man, I wish there were three other players, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree that 1v1 is just a completely different format than multiplayer, simply because the dynamics of what cards you put in change completely. And I don't want to talk too much about it, because I do have my thoughts about what 1v1 Commander is like, so we're actually going to do a 1v1 episode later in the future. So to all you guys listening out there, if you guys want to hear something about 1v1, we got it coming, so stick around.
Yeah, just in general, if you're interested in these alternate formats, like, this is just kind of, you know, to let you know they're on a radar, we're talking about them, that kind of thing. And I guess they should be on yours as well. If you want to mix things up, throw together a quick game of Star or Respawn Magic or Emperor or whatever. But in the future, we are going to be covering these as regular strategy segments, probably, you know, about on the same regularity as we do any segment, which is almost random. But yeah, expect to see more primers on these variant formats in the future. Like, the one-on-one episode is the next one coming up. Today we're doing Two-Headed. After that, I expect to be doing a Respawn Magic episode with Mr. Scotty Mack from the A-Team, because we've been experimenting with that a lot, and it's really cool. So that's pretty much it. This is just, you know, let you guys know what's going on as far as variant formats and EDH and Commander Cast goes. So with that, we're going to move into a special little segment here, because we have our second contest coming up. Season 2 has brought us all kinds of wonderful things, like guest hosts from the Rules Committee and from Wizards Official Site and some sites that we've kind of aligned ourselves with, like Wooburg. And now it's going to bring something to our expanded listener base. We've picked up a lot of new listeners this season, and I'm really grateful that you guys, you know, managed to calibrate your computers appropriately to catch us on the internet somewhere and put up with listening to my voice almost every week, some of you guys. So we're going to try to kind of give something back with another contest. Now, Secret Tech is by far our most popular segment, and we figure, you know what, well, let's bring the Secret Tech out to the people a little bit. So our second Commander Cast contest is, you guys are going to give us your Secret Tech. We want one common, one uncommon, and one rare from everybody who's submitting here. But that's not all. These three cards, there has to be some kind of unifying thread between them. So it could be that they're all of the same tribe. It could be that they're all combo pieces in the same combo. It could be that they're somehow thematic with the general or thematic overall. But there's got to be something that kind of ties them together. They can't just be three random, techie, lesser-known cards. And that's the premise. So we're going to be gauging things on how good the cards themselves are, how cool the unifying thread is between them, how secretive the cards actually are, and how little known they are. And all you got to do is send them in to commandercast@gmail.com. You've got to have the subject heading contest number 2. And that's it. We'll give them a look over. The contest will be open for 4 weeks. So you have until episode 10. When episode 10 is actually posted, that'll be when I stop accepting applications for the contest. And then me and the Goon Squad, we're going to go over the submitted entries. We'll probably do another Circle of Judgment like we did for the first Commander Cast episode. And now this probably sounds kind of sketchy to you guys, but we don't actually have the prize aligned completely. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have a prize in mind, because, you know, the first season we gave out a custom painted card by Sandrine, so you know I'm not fucking around when it comes to prizes. Like, the prize is going to be something pretty sweet. I'm actually talking to a couple of people, and there might be multiple prizes this time, as opposed to just one for the ultimate winner. But that's the contest, so to reiterate things, you send in me to me your secret tech. One common, one uncommon, one rare, and there has to be some kind of unifying thread between the three cards. Email them to commandercast@gmail.com. You have 4 weeks till episode 10. Once that in, we're going to announce the winner at the end of the final episode of the season, and they will receive the mystery prize. And like I said, there may be multiple winners this time. I'm still ironing things out with a couple of people on what the prizes are going to be, but they're going to be sweet. You know, don't get it twisted. This is going to be awesome. So that's the deal with contest number 2. Get working on your secret tech. Start dredging through your decks and find those lesser known cards, and get at us.
So I guess we're going to talk about some two-headed giant here, and just kind of start things off. I want to both get us clear on the two-headed giant rules that, you know, I prefer and that seem to be the most common to me, as well as kind of talk a little bit about some of the other ways people play. Basically, every different rule of two-headed giant has more than one way that people play it. There is the Wizards Comprehensive Rules, starting with rule number 800, where they do talk about their official two-headed giant, but it's more made for competitive play than it is for anything that adapts to Commander or EDH. The first major thing that you kind of have to work with is that both it and EDH change your life total. And with two-headed giant and EDH, I've heard everything from 30, 40, 60, and 80 as the common life totals that I've seen used. 30 because that's the two-headed giant one, 40 is the old two-headed giant and the current, you know, commander one, 60 because it's double two-headed giant, kind of like normal EDH is double regular life total, so to speak, and then also 80 because it's double commander life, which from my experience makes the game drawn so long that it just drives me crazy. I personally prefer 60 because it sort of splashes together the feel of both of the formats. Two-headed giant uses the 30, and then you double it because EDH doubles it. Also, in the comp rules, two-headed giant mentions using like 15 per head or something like that, so I figure using double that per head isn't a bad choice.
Yeah, it's just really important to have, like, those things seem so fundamental, and yet when you sit down to play a game of two-headed giant, people can suddenly realize halfway through, wait, we're not playing with the same rules. Like, hammer those out before the game, and make sure you know how things like a Magister Sphinx works when it resolves. Because yeah, you'll hear some crazy answers to that question. I'll tell you.
And
you'll get a lot of varying answers.
Yeah.
Even though there's only one right one.
And not just Magister Sphinx either. There's, you know, Beacons and Windcat, which is Philiadar Sovereign, I think is the real name of it. It's hard to remember the actual name of Windcat.
Yep. Feldar Sovereign.
And so on and so forth that care about your life total, and everybody has different opinions on whether or not that's broken, but from my experience, 60 is the best life total because it still draws the games out to what I would consider the length that EDH wants to be, but on the same note, it keeps it feeling like each player has some life total.
Okay, now beyond the life totals, what I find actually more interesting is the turn structure. Because more commonly these days, I see people playing, both players take their actions simultaneously. They both have the same untap, upkeep, draw, main phase, combat, second main, you know, end, cleanup, whatever, whatever. But before, a couple years ago, well, more than a couple years ago, a while ago, what we used to see a lot of was alternating. So player A on the first team would go, and then player B on the second team would go, and so on. So it would actually kind of move in a zigzag pattern around the table. And I think that's a more interesting turn structure, but it can make the game last a little longer. It can be a little more confusing. So I was just wondering what you guys, what your experiences were in terms of turn order, because I like alternating. I don't like everyone goes at the same time on the same team. Everyone has the same information then. It just kind of becomes the two guys sitting there and whispering about what their hands are and how they need to collaborate on this turn. Whereas if you take alternating turns, there's a little bit more of an introduction of a variable between turns. I think it makes the game a little bit more, makes the game a little deeper, but a little less accessible and easy to play.
Yeah, from my experience with the alternating turns thing, the reason, let's go back a little bit, the reason that they did the shared turns thing when Wizards wrote the comp rules was basically because tournaments would go to time if they didn't, and they try to avoid that. And along those same lines, if you want to play a really slow game and aren't too worried about the fact that people are probably going to forget whose turn is next, the alternating turns diagonal thing is how it was played when I was young, and it was an interesting dynamic, but I'm all for getting to the action, turning guys sideways. It's kind of a play style to play fast, and shared turns promotes that to a point where I feel much better than I'm sitting around less.
Another benefit to the alternating turns thing is that if everyone's taking a shared turn, like it's in any kind of multi-headed giant, then extra turn effects are really powerful.
Yes.
Because, yeah, instead of just one person getting an extra turn, now you have three opponents or two opponents getting an extra turn. Like, I've came across that accidentally, and it's just, it's ridiculous.
It makes Mindslaver a little more stupid than it already was, too, which is a incredibly negative side effect in my mind, because I hate Mindslaver.
Yeah, there are a lot of cards, especially they're Notorious and Commander, for being ridiculously powerful already, that just get even stronger than Two-Headed Giant. And that is kind of one of the nice things, that if you do, like, make it alternate turns instead of just one big turn altogether with your team, then it does keep those cards from just being even stronger. Because, I don't know, it just seems like that in, like, any game in general, like, when you try to change up the variables and try to make it, like, different from the norm, it just, like, the stupid, dumb, broken stuff just gets even more powerful. It's like a trend or something.
Yeah, like, look at EDH. That format is fucked. So yeah. Another thing I want to talk about with regards to playing two-headed is how much communication you permit between partners. Because that makes a huge splash on the game. Like, the slowest games of Magic I might have ever played that weren't Legacy were games where two players and two-headed were sitting there with their heads kind of together, whispering sweet nothings to each other about what their turn was going to be. And then at the end of the turn, they're like,
that optimal play.
Yeah, and then at the end of
the optimal play.
Oh my god, I know. And at the end of the turn, they get, okay, we'll pass our turn. Like, really? That took, like, more than 30 seconds, you know?
That's when you know they've got a counterspell or two up their sleeve.
Exactly, right? So, like, when you guys play two-headed, how much do you guys find is okay to sit there and chit-chat with your partner? When do you guys kind of put the brakes on that? Or have you guys ever played a game where you can't actually show your hand or anything to your partner and you can't really talk to them directly? Because I've done that, and I think that makes the game awesome.
One of the most fun things I've ever done is played two-headed giant with somebody I've known forever. When it's somebody who you actually just know really well, you can start using, you know, innuendo or even just things that you twitches that you could
visual
do.
Visual cues.
Blinking and Morse code.
Yeah, but like I played with my wife once, and we basically just kind of would show cards, and the other one of us would know kind of what the strategy we were thinking was, especially, you know, if we pointed to something in their hand, pointed something in our hand, there was an obvious synergy. You can do a lot with innuendo and just gestures, and that keeps it going a little faster. The long whispering does get frustrating.
You know, when it comes to conspiring with teammates, how far does that go? Like, do you talk with each other beforehand to say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to build this kind of deck, or I'm going to play this kind of deck, so you know, maybe you should put this in your deck because it synergizes well. You know, what goes on? Do you say, oh, you're playing Grand Arbiter, let me play Sakashima so they have to deal with two Grand Arbiters, or what?
That's actually an interesting consideration, is a metagame that's Two-Headed Giant. Because once people start expressly building decks for the purpose of playing Two-Headed, I find that's the part where it breaks down and stops being any fun at all. It's so easy to build two decks that are just smashingly broken together when you sit down and try to do that expressly. Two-Headed, I find, is definitely the most fun when you're sitting down with decks that are just designed to play a regular game of Magic or EDH, regardless of format. This isn't just an EDH thing. This is just Magic in general. When two decks are designed to play together properly, unless everyone's coming to play that way, and even then, I doubt it would be that much fun. It's definitely the most fun to just sit down and kind of, you know, you schoolyard pick your team, and you might not even know what one another's playing, and you just make the best of it. That's kind of part of the fun of it for me.
Yeah, I do like the randomization like that, but I've also played a few times where it wasn't what I'd say a tournament. Back when they had Arena League, I used to run in the Midwest when I lived down there. We ran events, and once we did a Two-Headed Giant, just whatever, bring decks. And, you know, the prizes were not based on wins. They were based on the number of games you played, and people brought some really fun, really just ridiculous combos that you would never think of. One of my favorites still is just bringing a Bizarre Trader and then giving your teammate a Lich's Mirror and then having them give you their Lich's Mirror.
I'm not going to lie, that is some pretty slick play on that part. But yeah, going back to the whole thing of like teaming up with someone where your decks are designed to just maximize synergy with each other, like I do agree that even though I don't really play Two-Headed Giant, I can see that it can just be disastrous, because I think if you like really want to play like quote-unquote competitive Two-Headed Giant EDH, I mean, it can get pretty bad. I mean, especially like one person can just play a combo deck, and the other person can just play Mono Blue Control, and then he can just protect the combo player counter spells, and then combo guy can just win on turn 4 or 5 with the backup he needs.
That's pretty true with any format, though. I mean,
it gets magnified even worse when you have an auxiliary player with you, though.
That's true. That brings up another point about Two-Headed Giant that is sort of out there in the open with the official Two-Headed Giant rules versus the old rules, is technically, according to Wizards rules, you're supposed to Highlander the combination of the two decks. So you play Counterspell, your teammate can't run a Counterspell. A lot of people don't play that way, but that's the official EDH or the official Two-Headed Giant rules if you want to get picky.
See, yeah, to me, those are the kind of rules that fall along this way of Partial Paris Mulligan and the 10-card sideboard, in that you'd have to be crazy to actually...
No one knows about him.
Yeah. And not only that...
No one knows about him, too.
With the double Highlander rule, where both decks have to be Highlander in this format, that's way too much preparation to expect people to do without expressly saying, we're going to play Two-Headed, and we're going to play it a lot. Like, there is no way I would sit down and build a deck like that without knowing who my teammate is and how often we're going to be playing. And it would have to be playing a hell of a lot to build a deck for that express purpose.
Yeah, that's also what we were talking about, though, is how that would be the most broken way, was if you were playing it to build, you know, specifically for Two-Headed Giant. And in that case, that rule is kind of a pretty good balancing factor, and it keeps that down to a minimum. There's still going to be somebody who brings that deck if you don't have a good... you know, social contract in place, but it does help.
Okay, now, Two-Headed Giant, a lot of the time when you bring it up, people imagine two teams of two sitting across from one another at a table and playing a game of Magic with some slightly altered rules. But how do you guys feel about playing Two-Headed with multiple giants, like where you have 8 players or 6 players? How do you guys find that kind of pans out within games? Because my experience, 6 players is kind of cool, 8 players sucks, and that's where you got to put the brakes on it.
Okay, well, I've never gone as far as to play with, like, 8 players, but 6 players, I think, I mean, that was a ton of fun when I played that format. Like, a little bit of the downside of the, just, like, regular Two-Headed Giant is that it almost feels like glorified 1v1, because you've got one life total versus another life total, and it's basically one person playing with, you know, a 200-card deck, drawing twice as many cards every turn. But, like, when you have, essentially... you know, 3 giants, then that just adds a whole nother political aspect to the game, and that to me is the optimum multi-headed giant format.
it's sort of a difficult balance. Like you're saying, it does basically end up being glorified 1v1 if it's just two two-headed giants, but even like regular multiplayer or any other EDH game, it's a tough balance between number of players and slowness of play. You obviously can't play two-headed giant with less than four, and four is probably what I would consider the optimal number for regular EDH. When you're getting into two-headed giant, six player starts to slow down pretty bad, but it's the first real multiplayer two-headed giant. Eight player does, in fact, suck, and it's pretty obviously that it would, because in any multiplayer game, that many turns to wait is just grueling. So I kind of like four because it gives me the one versus one and lets me play with some cards that I can't normally play with, because card advantage stops being so important, and you can start running a little bit of, you know, more spot removal. Some aggro decks become a little more viable. But on the same note, it does stop feeling as much like multiplayer, so it's kind of a trade-off. I think at the point when you're playing three two-headed giants, it just ends up being a three-player multiplayer game, so to speak. It doesn't feel different enough to me to justify playing two-head.
I think you guys are insane for considering like 4-on-4 Hydra EDH, or whatever the hell you want to call it. I mean, like, it's bad enough, as we've already said, like, having, like, an 8-player multiplayer game to begin with. But, with 6 players to begin with is already bad enough. I mean, like, 8 players for, like, a 4-on-4 glorified two-headed giant game would just be lunacy in my mind. I mean, there's got to be a point where it is fun to go all out and have some crazy shenanigans going around, but at the same time, you gotta at least have some common sense and consider logistics in mind when you're trying to plot your fun games and stuff like that, because it would really suck just having to wait, like, you know, like 5-10 minutes just to take another turn because so many people are doing their own thing and you're having to pass priority all the time and having to resolve all these triggers and activations going on the stack and things like that. I mean, like, You like Shu said, you're going to have to make a trade-off somewhere where if you're going to play two-headed giant, it's going to be more closer to 1v1 than it is multiplayer, or vice versa, where you're playing just a normal four-player multiplayer game. So that's kind of where I am there. I mean, at some point, we just got to use some common sense.
Okay, so now we've kind of talked about the logistics of it. We've talked about some of the base strategies of it and how they can vary depending on the rules that you've selected. So we're going to talk a little bit more specific about strategies related to two-headed giant now, and Shu is kind of going to take point here because he's the expert, so take it away.
Yeah, I actually have a couple of things I pulled from the comp rule that I want to kind of bring to everyone's attention, because there's stuff that people don't really think about, but they are obvious rules that people generally would use in two-headed giant. As the declare attacker step begins, the active team declares attackers, and if an effect or object by a defending player prohibits a creature from attacking, the creature can't attack the whole team. So, you know, propaganda suddenly is ridiculous in all of its ilk. Any kind of thing that prevents any kind of attacking just gets crazy. Ensnaring Bridge, amazing. It just totally locks down against both players. And on that same note, if an attacking creature would assign damage to a defending team, they choose a player, which makes cards like Worship, Dread, Orification, the ones that protect you when you're damaged, a lot worse, because they can always just choose to damage the other guy. So unless you've got some sort of weird Dread of your teammate playing Rite of Replication on it or something, Dread does nothing. So those two are kind of tied together.
That's interesting. I actually didn't know that one. So if I attack, let's say I'm playing against Byron and Donovan, if I have to attack them collectively, but then when I'm hitting them, I have to decide to damage Byron or Donovan?
Yeah, that's correct. Because if you think about it, cards like Hippie, who's discarding the card if you're hitting the team?
Yeah, for sure. So that's up to you. Okay.
They had to throw that in there for cards like Hippie, where, you know, target player discards a card at random when you hit him. So they,
yeah, definitely.
Hippie is hitting.
Because what I've always done is I actually attacked one player, but you were just able to block either guy. I guess it's effectively the same thing at that point.
There's also the whole blocking conditions being easier or harder to meet. Like fear suddenly becomes worse, because if either player can block fear, they can block it. But then, like, Landwalk suddenly becomes better, because if you are playing, you know, complementary pairs of colors, there's, like, you know, maybe one kind of Landwalk that's not basically the word unblockable. So that's another sort of secret tech of the two-headed giant world is, you know, land walk suddenly becomes really good.
That disappoints me, because I love to play Geth a lot now, and I just love the fact that he has Intimidate, and no one knows about it, really. And just, I don't know, stuff like him becomes worse. Cards like Dread become worse. But I guess it is for the logistics of the format, so I am willing to accept that.
Yeah, Dread becomes almost entirely useless just because Fear gets negated and his ability, where the damage is dealt, you choose to deal the other player. Dread gets really hosed by the format, which is kind of sad because it is a sweet card, but it gives other cards a chance to shine.
Now, another thing, another interesting thing that you have here is shared turns don't equal two different stacks, so it's a really decent strategy to kind of feint with a big spell. And then, you know, have yourself play the real strategy afterwards. Like, maybe you can draw out a counterspell with something else, and then suddenly, oh shit, Rite of Replication.
There's two sides to it, too, because that sort of can mess with people's heads when you're playing. Because what I've seen a lot of done, and it actually goes against the strategy we were just talking about, is I see people just, like, start piling stuff into play because they're thinking, oh, well, we have a shared turn. We share playing spells. But the truth be told is there's still one stack, so if I announce a creature, my teammate's not supposed to be able to announce the creature also because the stack's not empty. But I see people just piling these cards out, and it's like, dude, you could have totally just pretended you didn't have that, and then when they counter your teammate's thing you only kind of care about but is a good threat, then you drop your second combo piece and win, or, you know, whatever.
All right, so question. In your opinion, what do you think? How do you think the two-headed giant rules affect aggro in Commander? Like, I know instead of having to deal, you know, 80 damage between two people by yourself, you have two people working together, and you only have to deal 60 damage total, but at the same time, they're pulling their blockers, so what do you think?
I think aggro definitely gets a boost from it. Like I mentioned before, two-headed giant ends up a lot more like 1v1 if it's just four players, which is kind of the optimal configuration. And there's a point where aggro just stops being useful in any format with more than the average life total. But there's a fine line between mid-range and aggro in multiplayer, and the aggro strategies do definitely get a huge boost from it. I mean, I can justify playing things like Goblin Guide or, you know, early cheaper creatures that also have a late-game ability that's viable simply because their face-smashing early on is worth more. Also because removal gets better, though. There's the drawback that if they use their spot removal to kill your aggro dudes, nobody's down a card. So it kind of benefits you both in that they didn't waste a removal spell, but you also, you know, didn't, you don't lose card advantage from that.
Well, even though the like your opponents are drawing like double the cards, so they potentially have double the removal, you do have access to double the threats as well. And I'm always of the opinion that it's always better to have the proactive card than the reactive one, because if you have double the threats, then you're really going to force your opponent to scramble for answers, because like reactive cards are never going to get there. I mean, you got to play action to actually kill your opponent. So I actually think aggro does get a subtle boost in the fact that it is drawing double the threats, even though it has to take out a higher life total than in normal Magic.
Last thing I want to mention is that the comp rules have one other little sneaky thing that was changed recently that I didn't even know about. Your life total is the full life total now, not the halvesies that it used to be. So if you're looking with, like I said before, Windcat or Beacon of, what's the white beacon called? Beacon
Immortality.
Immortality. Those that doubles your life total, not half of your life total like it used to. Your life total is your team's total.
I didn't actually know that either. How recently did that change?
I do not know. It doesn't say, but that I just found that when I was
in the proper rules. So does that mean if you play Magister Sphinx or Soren Markov, it resets their entire life total to 10?
That's right.
Yeah, that puts them on Smash.
Wow.
Yeah, because we all know those cards were so much fun to begin with.
Pretty awesome.
Okay, so that's it for our segment on Two-Headed. I just want to say, it might not have been like, you know, we didn't go into specific, well, what decks are good with each other, that kind of thing. But honestly, you guys that are listening to this are smart enough to figure that out. Like, there's no point in us wasting our breath telling you that, oh man, if one guy plays counter magic and the other guy plays combo, that's probably going to be pretty sweet, herp derp, you know?
Yeah, and like I mentioned before, a lot of times people play to a giant just bring in whatever.
Yeah, and I think that is the kind of play that's probably best to promote overall, as opposed to, unless everyone is going with the same expectation, these decks were prepared to play together. It's just the most fun to sit down and kind of, you know, you might not even know who your partner is, you have no idea what their deck is, and you just go down and do your thing. But, yeah, you know, the strategies that are super obvious, there was no real point in bringing your attention to, so sorry if that's what you were expecting, but there's all kinds of forums and resources that you can look into if you need those kind of things, or just sit down and think about it for a minute. You'll come to these conclusions faster than I would, I can guarantee you that. So that's it for Two-Headed Giant. As always, if you guys have any thoughts of your own on this format, any strategies, any ideas in general, any questions even, feel free to email us, contact us in the show notes, and I'm sure Shu would be happy to get around to answering those as well on his own website.
So, yeah, on the top right corner of my site, there's a contact us form, and you're more than welcome to send any questions, comments, anything related to Two-Headed Giant. I'm more than willing to answer it. I check it almost every day.
This week on Break My Card, we're doing Infernal Genesis. So this was a rare enchantment. It was printed in Prophecy, so you know it's good. It's 4 colorless and 2 black, and at the beginning of each player's upkeep, that player puts the top card of his or her library into his or her graveyard. He or she then puts X11 black minion creature tokens onto the battlefield, where X is that creature's converted mana cost. Now, shout out to Bruce from the Muse Vessel, because he was playing this as kind of a centerpiece for a deck he was playing when I was hanging out with him in Boston. And it was pretty awesome. And I noticed I had a copy of my binder, so I was thinking, you know what? Let's put this thing to work. Let's have some of my Twitter mans go into the lab. Maybe they can come up with some way to make it workable. So, you guys probably know the format for Break My Card, but if you don't, this is only for my Twitter people. You can follow me as @CommanderCast. And what you got to do is you send me a single tweet explaining how you're going to break this card. Now, the tweet has to include who the general is at the helm of the deck. But other than that, anything goes. You can use slang, you can use short forms, you can use acronyms, whatever. I just got to be able to understand what you're saying in 140 characters. You can't explain your tweet to me in some other format. So that's it. Infernal Genesis. Let's see what you guys can come up with. I've been getting some really good entries off the last couple that I thought were really worthless cards. Psychic Vortex and Carnival of Souls in particular, I have actually put them into decks now, and they're actually doing pretty good. So if we can get the same results from Infernal Genesis, I will be very pleased. But I've gotten some really great entries, and I want those to keep coming. So again, @CommanderCast, Infernal Genesis, make sure you include the general, let's see what you guys can do.
So, continuing on our technology segment for this week, we're going to be talking about alternate casting cost cards, or aka free spells. And for those of you who aren't too familiar with the term I'm talking about, they're basically spells that have some sort of alternate casting cost instead of just paying their mana cost. And usually the most common card that comes into mind is Force of Will. But for this section, I'm going to be talking about cards not just called Force of Will, where you can pay some sort of cost to them that you don't have to pay mana to. And the reason I'm going to be talking about a lot of this stuff is because I've been dabbling with a lot of these kind of cards lately, and I've been finding them really useful, especially because the fact that since they're usually free to cast, there's a lot of surprises you can pull with them. And I feel that a lot of what, if you want to really like take your deck to the next level in Commander, it's not just about like making cards like that have the strongest effects or have the strongest power to mana cost ratio, but just cards that allow you to do some sort of thing that no one ever expects. Because a lot of times when people get wrecked in Commander, it's usually because they get blindsided by something they don't even expect. So I want to first talk out with one alternate casting cost card that has really become one of my favorites like in the past month or so, and it's called Submerge. If you don't know what Submerge is, it is a 5-mana instant that's blue. But if you control an island and any of your opponents control a forest, you can cast it without paying its mana cost. And it allows you to put target creature on top of its owner's library. And cards like this are just really good for surprising people because they don't expect you to do something when you're tapped out. And that's exactly what a lot of these cards do in general. So I know this is going to basically turn into its own little secret text segment, but I do think there are some really good aspects to just the whole surprise factor of alternate casting cost cards in general.
When you mentioned surprise factor, the first thing that makes me think of, and it's also kind of the way I tend to use these when I do, the instant speed ones are almost the only ones that ever make it into my decks. There are some other ones I try and try to find space for, but it's just really hard to justify paying an alternate cost if it's not an instant speed to surprise somebody. I really love, like, Delrock, sure, however you pronounce it, the 6-6 trample for sack three black creatures.
Delrock? I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's hard to pronounce, but it's really cool because it's a 6-6 for, you know, trample for sacking dudes. And since it doesn't flash in, it just, why would I ever do that instead of just paying the 7? I mean, I'm sure I've got a coffers in the deck, and even if I don't, it's so easy to get to 7 mana, and at 7 mana, play something better.
Okay, now this is something that I was also going to cover on before I gave you guys some time to talk, but I will say this right now. There are many of these alternate casting cards are just not that good in this format. Like, Delrake, probably not so much. But I mean, a card like Submerge, for example, you do get the surprise factor out of it, mainly because it's instant speed, but because it is an ability that no one ever expects you to do. I mean, like, when Blue's tapped out, you expect that shields down moment, and you're just going to go all out on them and expect them not to counter anything, because who's going to draw that one Force of Will in their deck, let alone run it in their deck to begin with? But also, for the most part, I mean, like, if you want to play some other action, but your mana is tied up in something else, like, say you're playing mono green, and you want to cast your general, like Sylvos, for example, or Jorul, or Kamal, or whatever random green general you're running, but you also want to clear the board of some enchantments, but you also want to have your general as some board presence at the same time. Well, if you play a card like Reverent Silence, which basically says it's a 4-mana sorcery that's green, instead of paying its mana cost, if you control a forest, you can have each opponent gain 6 life, and you get to destroy all enchantments. So you get some action in there without losing tempo, which is another benefit of alternate casting cards as well, instead of just the surprise factor, is that it doesn't tie down your mana, so you can do other stuff that also furthers your board position at the same time.
Alright, so Byron, would you consider stuff like Slaughter Pact one of these cards? Because, I mean, it kind of has an alternate cost where you just pay it next turn instead of this turn.
I would consider packs in general to meet this prerequisite, because although you do have to pay the mana cost later, I mean, the whole point is that you're tapped out, your opponents assume you're not going to do any more action, and you just throw out a pack out of nowhere, and people are just like, what just happened? So you do have to tie down some mana on your next turn, but the fact that you still have the surprise factor going, I would lump packs in that same category.
One of my favorite things to do as far as the alt cost cards go is Force of Will is specifically good because it's an answer. So I like a lot of the answer ones, like Snuff Out is a really nice card to have up your sleeve. So like you were talking about before with the surprise factor with the alt cost cards, I much prefer to use it with removal spells. Abolish, the one that does disenchant if you discard a planes, I've found to be quite nice to surprise the survival player or some other thing like that. And then also I play with Snuff Out quite a bit, because what's 4 life in EDH, and it's really nice to just destroy a non-black creature when nobody's noticing. I mean, I wish it killed black creatures too, obviously, but it's nice. And then I actually forget what we were playing, but somebody mentioned more than once that they wish that there was an alt-cost Fog, and there actually is. It's called Snag, and all you have to do is discard a forest. And I forget what kind of Alpha Strike was going on, but they wish they had it.
That's pretty sweet, actually, an alt-cost Fog.
It is kind of an awkward alternate casting cost, though, because you have to discard a forest. So it is a little awkward.
But generally, if you're playing green, you have a lot of fetch forest stuff to fetch your duels, so you probably have regular forest too, so, and you'd rather not have them than die. So, I mean, if you're drawing
that
extra,
is true.
If you're drawing extra land, your land becomes a fog, sort of.
Yeah, I play a lot of basic lands too, so.
If you've ever played with foil, the poor man's Force of Will, its alt casting cost is discard an island and another card. So, I mean, you're kind of 3-for-1-ing yourself. But, I mean, it's still very playable, and what happens is when it's in your hand, you actually, like, consciously keep islands in your hand. Like, you don't have to make every single land drop. You can hold one back.
One of my other favorite ones is always going to be the Misdirection as well, because who doesn't like, you know, swerve, surprise, swerve? It's just funny.
So if you don't know what Misdirection does, it's a blue instant that costs 5 mana, 2 blue and 3 colorless. You can choose to exile a blue card in your hand rather than pay Misdirection's mana cost. And target spell with a single target targets another target instead. So it's basically a swerve effect, basically, for no mana. I run my Sagashima deck on Cockatrice. I'm trying to get one for my real-life deck because I know they're like $10 now. But it is amazing to just blindside someone when they try to Identity Crisis you, and you just misdirection them in response while you're tapped out.
Another alt cost card I'd like to play with, but I don't think I've ever paid the alt cost, is Shining Shoal. It's like the only Shoal that's particularly playable, but it the next X damage that a source of your choice would deal to you or a creature you control this turn is dealt to target creature or player instead. And that's just a lot of fun to throw on, you know, their Blightsteel Colossus or something.
Yeah, that's actually really pretty sweet.
It's really hard to discard a 12-cost white card if that even exists. I don't think it does. I take that back. Autocathon Worm is white, so there's always that.
No, I just wanted to say that Sickening Shoal, the black one, is actually really good. It you can pitch a black card from your hand and give a creature -X/-X until end of turn, where X is that card's converted mana cost. And
that's true. I can see that one being good.
Yeah, and like you said, the fact that it's an answer makes it a lot better. Looking through these, I want to give Pyrokinesis a shot too, where you can pitch a red card from your hand to deal 4 damage you want divided up among creatures. It just seems so good when you're answering like early generals without having to lose tempo.
Yeah, I used to play that a lot, but I never ran it in EDH. I've played it in other formats and enjoyed it. A couple of the other ones that are really cool to look at is there's some sweepers in here with alt costs, like Pulverize, Sack 2 Mountains, the Shatterstorm. Not bad.
Yeah, that's not bad at all, actually.
Pulverize is one of those cards that it is kind of really, it is one of those cards that I really don't really like to play in a red deck because it does set you back so far, even though you're pulverizing, you're just destroying a whole lot of artifacts because red is one of those colors that is pretty bad when it comes to mana ramp, and when you're having to sack two of your mountains to cast for free, I mean, it's really going to exacerbate the situation. There is one card, though, that I do kind of like that I think is kind of nifty for red. It's called Mog Salvage. And if you don't know what it is, it's a 3-cast red instant, 1 red and 2 colorless. And if any opponent controls an island and you control a mountain, you can cast Mog Salvage without paying its mana cost. It's just destroy target artifact.
I didn't want to close out this segment without mentioning Dream Halls. You know, if you like the free spell effect, you know, why not get the whole table in on it? That's just awesome.
The only problem I've ever seen with Dream Halls is it usually ends up in being discard my crap to get a bomb, discard my something else to disenchant Dream Halls, go.
And there's a problem with that?
I mean, the next player tends to be the one doing it, not you.
Oh, true.
That's what I've seen, is somebody who has, like, Veldhaken Ori out goes, I barf my stuff on the table to disenchant your thing, go.
The whole point to keep in mind is a lot of these abilities are not like Identity Crisis or Plague Wind or Decree of Pain, where you're going to get a ridiculous ability for nothing. That's not the point of these alternate casting cost cards. The point is the fact that you're doing some sort of action when your opponent's least expect it. And I really do feel that when it comes to it, that alternate casting cost effects are good. Even though you get one little effect out of it, you're seriously surprising your opponent and just you're just blindsiding them just completely. I mean, you redirect that 20-point blaze back at them for doing nothing, except just pitching a blue card with misdirection. Or you're saving yourself from a lethal combat step by playing Snag and ditching a forest. I mean, surprises really do win games in this format, and I am a firm believer of that.
That rounds out this episode of Commander Cast. We were talking about Two-Headed Giant, variant effects, free cards, all kinds of good stuff. So, in summary, with this episode, here's some stuff that you guys can interact with us with in particular. We'd really appreciate it. We're still running Carlos's deck building challenge. So, this is the second week where you have to vote on his first restriction. Be sure to check out commandercast.blogspot.com, and in the upper left-hand corner, if you haven't voted already, vote on the restriction you want to see him building around. Also, this week we got Break My Card on Twitter, as always. We're doing Infernal Genesis this week. And last but most certainly important, we have the contest, the second contest. It's the Secret Tech Contest. The rules are going to be on the website in case you didn't hear them somehow while you were listening to the podcast. So be sure to email us, commandercast@gmail.com. Like I said, @commandercast is my Twitter account and the show's Twitter account in general. You can also get a hold of most of us. We introduce ourselves, we gave our forum handles, etc. You can find us on the official EDH forums, and most of us are also on Salvation. So you can find us there. And the final way you can get a hold of us is through comments on our website or on mtgcast.com. In case you didn't know, we are also now on Channel Fireball. I want to thank those guys again for hosting us there. And yeah, I think that's just about it. Our guest this week was Shu of Wooburg.com. Do you have anything to close it out with here, Shu?
Nothing really other than to just say if you've got any kind of questions about any kind of alternate formats, you're more than welcome to use the Contact Us form on my website or email me at shu_wooburg@snobbywalrus.com. Pretty easy to remember there. And I'm more than willing to post format ideas, get back to you on any kind of rules, strategy, even suggestions for articles are more than welcome.
All right, so that's it for CommanderCast this week. Be sure to check back on Thursday for our midweek update, and come back again on Monday where we'll have another episode posted.